Welcome to the Derek Loudermilk Show. This is episode 383 with David Verdesi. David Verdesi is an Indiana Jones type figure, maybe a spiritual, metaphysical Indiana Jones. And he spent decades traveling the world studying under master shamans, gurus, yogis, monks. He became a monk, studied with saints, and I first encountered him through a documentary series about his journeys called Searching for Superhumans, which shows incredible footage, amazing, you know, miracles, feats of these energy masters, qigong masters, levitation, reading blindfold, harnessing qi to send electrical shocks, all that stuff. But he says that's not really the point of his journey. The point was a personal journey of discovery. But he's had so many years of studying under these masters that I was so curious about his travels and what he learned that I had to get him on the show. And so today he's going to tell us about all of his years of Indiana Jonesing around and also share some of the metaphysical lessons and practices with us that we can use in our own advancement. So this is a very exciting interview for me, and I'm sure you're going to love David Verdesi. Here he is. David Verdesi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you for having me.
And maybe we could start with this interesting synchronicity that occurred as I was preparing to speak to you, which was 3 days prior to this interview. I had a dream of a sort of a square concentric city, which upon waking, I realized was probably the temple at Borobudur in Indonesia. And then the following day, I was watching a video, a teacher who's teaching about the use of crystals and land healing. And she had constructed a grid, which looked just like the temple at Borobudur. And then on the third day, I watched your first video in the documentary series and on the Book of Knowledge. And there you are walking up the steps of this temple in Borobudur. So what do you make of that? And can you tell us a story about how you came to be filming at Borobudur?
All right. I wanted to find the metaphor that would convey the meaning of what are the mandalas. And the mandalas are themselves metaphor for the mind, for a mind that has been ordered. I like to use the Greek word of cosmos. Cosmos literally means order. So mandalas are structures, are metaphors, are symbols, allegories of order. And specifically, when we say order, here it means the ordering of the mind-body sort of unity or wholeness or connection into his ideal state. And that state is refer to it in sort of using Asian terminology, you know, this idea of enlightenment, of this awakening. And so the different layers of the mandalas, they represent the layers which they are called the skandhas. That is the Sanskrit word that means the aggregates that make us us. And so, you know, nama and rupa, name and forms. And then you have feelings, perceptions, volition, and then consciousness itself, which is seen as one of the aggregates. So it's not seen as a fundamental, it's seen as an aggregate. And so the penetration of the mandala that symbolized the penetrating through, seeing through the aggregates which we believe to be ourselves, this force, this body, which is the fundamental illusion, the belief that we are these, and the name, so the avatar of David and Derek, which has a story, a narrative, his suffering, his journey to liberation. It's all happening at the level of this name, okay, this little avatar that we create. And then, you know, the feelings, the perception, the volition, what do we want, and the very consciousness which we identify. So I chose Borobudur because it's one of the most impressive sort of, existing mandalas, rather than speaking of a mandala in a painting. I wanted to choose something that had a visual impact, that really expressed this higher order of the enlightened mind, where every element of the mandala represents an element of being that has been integrated and ordered to express the quality of awakening, of Buddha. And then how each of the elements of the layers of the mandala represent a part of our perceived identity that we need to shed, to pierce through, or to dissolve, or conquer, whichever word you want to use. So that probably is why I chose that. Which leads to the fundamental question, that is the driving force, was the driving force in my journey. It's like, who am I? Okay. And that drive, that drive to know, which is kind of paradoxical, is what pushed me. Okay, and so Borobudur for me represented that, and the mandala, the structures, very much represented the map, dimension.
And you, in this series, got some feedback there. Series, you talk about your journey and starting many years ago. What got you started on the journey in the first place?
It's a good question. I always say that it's the stick and the carrot. It's the pain that push you and the carrot, so the pleasure, or what you identify as pleasure, or your goal, or idea that pulls you. So it's a combination of both. Now, I was very, very young, talking about 4 or 5 years old, and sort of these memories or recollection of people called past lives. I don't know if they were past lives. I was born in Italy and in a non-religious family or anything, non-affiliated with Asian culture, but I had this vivid recollection of these teachers in Asia and me meditating, blah, 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 blah. So it was always this very strong urge, maybe like a pain of something that I missed, that I needed to find again. In this vision, the state of, let's say, bliss or pleasure when being in the presence of these masters or being in these meditation states that kind of occurred to me kind of naturally. And then there were many other events, which now are long to tell, but that's pretty much really the subtle journey. So it was like a series of strong vision and strong early childhood experiences that had me questioning and nobody really could answer. So I only had what I saw in my visions and what I felt inside of myself, this energy, this current running through me as a guide. And nobody else really. So I had to just rely on that. So that's really what kind of pushed me at the time.
Did you end up finding any person or location in particular that you remembered?
All of them. All my visions were accurate. They all were real places, real people. And that's really what drive me from one to the next. And they came randomly. And sometimes they were like overwhelmingly real, like overnight, like I'm sitting drinking coffee or having a meal and just this reality disappeared and I just I am somewhere else. You know, sometimes people have to, hello, and, you know, zoom back here, and I'm like, I know where I need to go. You know, I've been called. I see a person calling me or showing me specific places or specific indicators, you know, that then I could find a place. So yes, that was quite peculiar. I don't have these visions anymore. They disappeared maybe in my 30s or something like this, probably. Yeah. But they were with me for many, many years.
So you would see a location, a scene, someone, and you would know exactly where that was on the globe, and you knew that it was time for you to go to that place?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes it was very vivid visions with these people talking to me, or telling me literally where to go, or sometimes just clear vision of places with identificators that would literally allow me to find, or just the knowledge. I know that the place is in Africa, or in Malaysia, or in China, or in India. You know, it's like, it's not even a voice, it's just the knowledge. You know where the place is, from there you start. It was always a journey, you know, don't get me wrong. You know, it's like you get on an airplane and you have some coordinates, but still, especially we're talking of over 30 years ago, there was no mobile telephone, no Google, no internet. You know, it was just me there asking questions, say, you know, I saw this and there is a person and there is a temple like this, or there is something like this, and it looked like this, you know.
Can you share an example of one that sticks out for you right now?
Well, not necessarily one that sticks out, but more maybe one that is possibly more known by people in the West. So one of my teachers was this gentleman known as the Magus of Java, John Chang. And there is a book about him, and I didn't read the book or anything. At the time, I was in Thailand, and I just had this, you know, very clear vision of him, although I never sort of met him personally, of a statue of a Buddhist bodhisattva. And a name, literally just a name. And I didn't know what that name was. And so I had to make my research, and then I found that it was the name of a city. And so I literally flew to the city in Indonesia. And when I arrived in the city, I asked everybody, where is this statue? Where is this statue? And... you know, I say it's a big statue, like this, like this, like this. So it's temple here, the Chinatown here. And then I arrive there, I hang around, okay, I'm around the statue and you know, looking for the man that looked like in my vision and starting to ask people. And of course, you know, I ask the right guy that says, I know who you're talking about. But I mean, you know, John had this kind of, it belonged to a fairly small number of people that have these unique abilities, this, you know, what I came to know as the real Kundalini, that feels like this very strong electrical current, you know, like real physical electrical current. And so it's like, it's fairly easy to identify people because not many people can do that, right? And so I ask, you know, I'm looking for this guy, you know, he has this. And the guy said, oh, yeah, I know very well you look for you before. And that's how I got there. This is just one story, not necessarily the most important one, but one that maybe people may relate to because maybe they read the book.
It sounds like a really fun scavenger hunt in a way.
Yeah, it was a big Indiana Jones kind of journey, and it was like all these tales. It's it's fun and nice to tell them in retrospective, but it was a lot of hardship, you know, like sleeping on streets and then and monasteries. I mean, I left it. I had nothing. I was like 15 years old, you know, and then, you know, I just left. And I went to Asia and Africa and, you know, all these places and with barely speaking English, mine, you know. So, yeah, that was good. That was a good journey.
Wow. Did you go and did you learn from this person about Kundalini, or what was the outcome of that particular?
Yeah, you know, all of this teacher, whoever came to my visions, I knew that those were people that I had to go and meet. And then receive either teachings or remembrance, like remembering what I already learned. Because a lot of these practices, I already sort of remember them from my childhood, right? And so sometimes I just have to go meet them. For example, from John, yes, I ended up learning, and there is a whole story there. But yes, him and many others. I mean, I think that altogether there must have been well over 100 sort of teachers that you know I encountered in this long journey. Some more memorable than others, some that touched me more deeply than others, but that has been, you know, for sure a very populated journey, let's say like this.
Yeah. And if you were to sort of speak about a theme or connect the dots of the journey, what was the purpose of the journey?
Love, of course. What else? Love is the answer, and when you really understand that that's the answer, there are no more questions. But it can take decades to really understand that that's the answer. So what I tell you now is love. During the journey, I thought that something else was the answer, and according to the phase of the journey or my age, which, you know, again, span over 30 years, so logically I grew from a young boy to a man. Many things changed logically: the perceptions and priorities and values, and, you know, what I thought it was important or meaningful.
In one of the series that you created about searching for superhumans, you know, the focus is really on people's special abilities that they've cultivated. Is there one that you're most, that you think is the most remarkable or the most interesting to you?
You know, so first of all, let me say that I didn't produce or made this documentary. This was a production desired by the creator of The Secret, you know, the law of attraction and everything.
Yes.
Drew Aries. Yeah. And he wanted to create, you know, this kind of a Marvel-like superhero, Harry Potter, Matrix, you know, thing. And can you imagine, originally the plot was that Keanu Reeves should have been kind of traveling with me to learn all this, you know, kind of stuff. So it was really his erotic fantasy. It was never mine, okay, personally. And quite the opposite. I've always was kind of against to try to portray these special abilities on video for many reasons. I mean, first and foremost is because I believe that they just don't look real. And I think that there is a backlash, there is a resistance immediately from people when they see something like this, especially, you know, a public that is used to Hollywood movie and visual effects that are so overwhelming. And many of these things, they really don't look like anything when they really actually happen in front of you. The second reason is that it puts focus and attention on what's not important, that are these kind of special abilities. Third is that is extremely and was extremely difficult to find some people that were actually willing to go on camera to do these things. I mean, you know, I think I've asked maybe 40 people that have the special abilities to please come and do, bribing them with money, with fame, with girls, you name it, okay? But very, very few, you know, consider to that. And so pretty much the one or two that you see in the documentary are the people that sort of agree to. They are not necessarily the most impressive ones, but are the ones that you know, were willing. So I need to say this is very important for me. Okay.
Okay.
This whole focus on the superpower, you know, was never my intent, and it is still not my intent. I still don't believe that it was the main focus of my journey, my research. But I did witness a lot of these supernatural things, from levitation, materialization, teleportation, telekinesis, you name it. Okay, spirit manifestation, you name it. Just you name it, and I was there. Okay. But it was never for me the thing. Okay. So, yeah, you know, that's what I have to say. I mean, there were really many, you know, impactful kind of miracle-like experience that I've seen, you know, through the years. If you ask me one that touched me, probably was a Christian mystic. So not in Asia or anything, a Christian mystic, an old man that spent his life in prayers in the mountains of Central Europe. And he lived in a small hut, you know, in the forest up in the mountain. And according to the devotees, you know, he didn't sleep and didn't eat for the past 40 years. He never lay down to sleep. So he was constantly in prayer and many things. So I decided I did a lot of research in Christianity, not the church Christianity, but the actual sort of mystical part of it. And I decided that I wanted to really experience the meaning of the baptism. And when they speak of the descent of the fire, of the spirit of the fire. Right? So, you know, anyway, long story short, I was looking for some real Christian mystics. And when I went to meet him to prepare for this process, you have to do kind of, you know, purifications and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, well, when this old man was reciting some prayers, he literally started to levitate. Now, I had seen levitation before. I even did it, not for my own great achievement, but when I was with the teacher, that they did something, and, you know, I ended up 2 centimeters off the floor, not because I have any great achievement myself. But the difference was that whereas when I have seen or experienced this levitation phenomena was just a matter of fact, okay, you are off the floor, or you see someone, you know, kind of floating. But nothing changes inside. When this holy man was levitating through the ecstasy, through the bliss of his prayers, you know, what me and the other people around, and I'm a very skeptical person, okay? So I'm not one of those guys that, you know, goes in trance or in ecstasy easily. Okay? But when he started to do this prayer and his ecstasy lifted him up, we were all lifted up. And the experience of ecstasy, of being lifted in literally the presence of love, okay, of God, of light, it was so incredible and overwhelming, which it set it apart from all other, for example, levitation experiences I witnessed, that there was not a levitation only of the flesh of the body, but there was a rising, okay, of literally of your being, of your spirit, to touch something which, you know, can hardly be put into words. So that is one thing. And then, you know, when I did this ceremony, you know, you have to be plunged into this huge cauldron, you know, size of a grown man, of icy cold water, and you come out of it and it's cold, and you are plunged into the icy water with the, like, this thick cotton white gown, basically. Okay. We put on for the process of purification. So when you come out of it, you are just freezing with this cold thing on you, and it's cold in the mountains. Now, I am familiar with the internal fire practices, which I have personally practiced to a fairly good degree of success. So I know the process that you can use your internal heat to dry the wet sheets, but it does require quite a lot of work on your hands to do that. And instead, without no work on my hands, again, this old mystic, he started to recite the prayer of the, you know, receiving the presence of the fire of the spirit. And this fire just came, you know, all through me, and literally in 10 seconds, you know, I was like steaming. The heat was like, you know, drying this wet gown.
Wow.
And again, not only the physical sensation, but this profound sense of inner resolve, of inner purification of the core of the being is difficult to kind of express. So if you ask me some, for example, some interesting experience, this for sure I count it as an important one, because I'm a Western man grown up in although I was raised in a largely an atheist background. But, you know, I was raised like you, like most people listening, into, let's say, a Judeo-Christian, you know, kind of background,
yes,
historical background, right? So you cannot completely cut it off, right? And so to experience something so real and profound, not in the usual suspect, with the shaman, with the Hindu yogi, the Tibetan monk, or the Taoist wizard, but to experience something so profound in the cultural matrix that we emerge from, for me was definitely an highlight. Mm-hmm. I have experienced something similar with the Tibetan monks, with Hindu yogis, with Taoists, you know, yes. But that one was for sure something that stood out.
Wow. What a wonderful experience. I'm super curious. What does it feel like when you levitate?
Well, I mean, the two times that it happened to me, when I was with two of my teachers, and both of them, they were Taoist teachers. Taoism, it's sort of my early childhood until my young adulthood that was very focused on these Taoist practices. Okay. And I had the luck of meeting some truly remarkable and accomplished abbots. And so the two times that happened with these teachers, one of them is actually another person that there is a book about his life, Wang Yiping, Opening the Dragon Gate. The Making of a Modern Taoist Wizard, I think is the English title. Anyway, nothing really, that's what I say. You just are busy and focused in your internal doing, working with your energy and, you know, making a lot of effort and very concentrated and yeah, that's it. And then you are off the floor. It doesn't feel like anything. So there was no any great particular, thing. It's just a matter of fact. I mean, you do something with your energy in some way, and it happens. I mean, another time that it happened, we were with a good friend of mine, actually two good friends of mine, and in the house of these other teachers in southern China. And the same, it's like, he's there and reciting the mantra and whistling around and going around and touching our head and arranging the energy field. I mean, God knows whatever what, right? And, I'm sitting there and, you feel this sense of, kind of lightness and soul, which is a very important aspect of the training, right? To learn to be kind of erect and suspended from above is a key of many energy cultivation and meditation sort of forms, let's say like this, right? So I'm familiar with the feeling. So nothing new. I just felt something that I was used to feel. And then one of my friends would say, David, I'm like, what? Say, look, say, what? You are levitating. I'm like, come on, man. That's it. I mean, my mind was in no whatsoever any great mystical state. That was like the conversation with your body, right? I said, I'm serious. I opened my eyes, you were sit. When you are with this teacher, it's very strict. You need to sit in full lotus, okay? So not just comfortable, cross-legged. You need to sit in full lotus. And I looked and I literally was off the floor. But, nothing particularly, transcendentally happened in my soul or in my spirit.
And what's the physics explanation? Was your body ultra light, or what was happening to make you levitate? Any idea?
I am not a physicist. I have no idea. I tell you the truth.
I think I'm personally similar to the producer in where I'm coming from, and that I think people seeing superhuman or sort of miraculous things is like a very dramatic entry point into an awareness that they need to expand what's possible. But what do you think, like, are miracles, like you're talking about with levitation, is it really just a byproduct of, you're just doing your practices, or is there a use for them in order to like accelerate someone's evolution?
They're just tricks.
Just tricks.
You know that if you put water on fire, it's going to boil. Like, that if you do this and this with your energy and your mind, there's going to be some result. It's like a trick. A trick doesn't mean it's, you understand what I mean as a trick. It's like it's a skill. It is something that once you understand what to do, you can, depending on the level of mastery, of course, you can pretty much repeat it. But it has nothing whatsoever to do with let's call it enlightenment or awakening. It's I know it's a big perspective false that people have, as I partly have. You associate the superhuman with the spiritually perfected, because maybe we were told in stories in our childhood that Jesus walked on water, resurrected the dead, and did all this miracle, multiplied the bread and the fishes, blah blah blah, healed the sick, and maybe there is an association in our mind that think that, okay, so there is an association between me doing super feats and me being holier or closer to know, closer to God. I can assure you that that's not the case. So there is a correlation, but not a causation. That's very important. Very important. You spoke of physics, you speak of science. discerning between correlation and causation is fundamental. There is a lot of phenomena that are correlated, but there is no direct causation. Meaning that, let's just stay for a second on these Taoist things, you know, this Qigong and Taoist practice. Okay? Just because it's maybe easier to explain it using this. The word Qigong in Chinese, it means literally skill, mastery of the energy. Okay. There isn't anything spiritual about it. Okay, there are many great Qigong masters. I mean, I've met a few of them with incredible skills. Terrible human beings. Terrible. One of my teachers, I kid you not, he was a hitman for the Chinese triads. He was a killer.
Goodness.
Okay. But the powers of this guy were like, you know, Voldemort, you know, scary power. Nothing to do, but he was a great master of, you know, Qigong and the Tao. So I just give this as an hyperbolic example to say that there is no direct causation in turning your energy, moving it up through the chakras, or I don't know what, or do what, and you being a better person, or you being any inch closer to love, to God, to awakening, to being Buddha, or whatever. Zero, just zero. Okay. Now, conversely, it's also true that many of these great saints, which have come to know the nature of the mind, which is a Buddhist term for sort of, you know, an awakening, or they are liberated souls or self-realized souls, it is true that then display an array of incredible abilities. And also that is true when I've seen some of my teachers that are real holy people, for example, Buddhist tradition, are really have all this kind of, they call siddhis, perfections, and leaving footprints on rocks and dissolving the body into light like rainbows and making rain of miracle, you know, just incredible things, like fairy tales. It's real. Okay. But it's different between what they call a dharma siddhi, like a perfection that comes from the realization of dharma, and dharma is the law of love, okay? Or siddhis that come from the cerebral and egoic manipulation of your inner energy. Okay? Mm-hmm. I've also studied with magicians, real magicians, alchemists, magicians, people that can, you know, do magic using their sexual energy and their intent and talisman and bounding spirits to their wheels. And also these guys, they can do incredible stuff in Indonesia, in Papua New Guinea, in Africa, in, you know, I've seen like in southern part of India, or, you know, I've seen also the real magicians, like, wow. but that one has nothing to do. This is just the egoic manipulation of the forces of nature. So that's why I say there is a correlation but not a causation. It's very important to distinguish the two.
So you studied under this hitman, this Qigong.
I didn't know that he was a hitman, honestly speaking, so to be very honest. And I've discovered it, you know, later. And when I discovered it, I literally pretty much ran away.
When you were studying under him, what was that like?
Hard, very hard. You know, I was the only white guy. Spoke few words of Chinese, and you know, every morning you have to stay in the obey position, straight like a soldier, okay? And wait for the teacher in that position until he comes. You never know when he comes. Maybe 1 hour, maybe 2 hours. Maybe he's there watching you, but you don't know. Okay? But if you move, he's definitely not going to come. You have to stay and wait. Okay? And the meeting started before dawn. So you have to be there before dawn. And wait your teacher that he would come up any moment. And then he would arrive, he looked at me, and he says, the world is like an egg. It's yellow in the center and white around, referring to the yellow man and the white man.
Okay. Okay.
And when you mix the egg, it becomes all yellow. Remember, you quello, quello is a dispregiative term. You know, to speak about white people, okay? We're like smelly ghosts, okay? Very hot. And the training was brutal, just brutal, I can assure you. But I was young and I loved it, you know? It's like, give me more, I want to suffer, you know? And then, of course, you know, I was excited when then I was kind of given to this group of women that they keep the secret of the sexual practices. But I was given to them as a gift, so fundamentally for them to milk me, to use my energy. But then, because they wanted to enroll me because all these people, they all work for the tribe. And they saw an opportunity with a white man. And so I also started to resist some teaching. And of course, it was fascinating, but it was all very wrong. And then when I realized what was happening, I just
left. How did you realize?
The girl that I was given in training for, she was my curator, she told me, do you know what you're getting yourself into? And I was like, no, I'm learning Qigong, you know. He said, no.
So if you had continued down that path, would you have been some sort of like energy, like a battery that they were using for energy, or would you have become a hitman, or what would have happened?
I have no idea. You know, I left. I have no idea. I didn't let my mind linger on this matter. The point is that, you know, again, it was a long journey. And there were some very transcendental moments, and there were some very wrong moments. And because, you know, I was driven by these visions, but I was also driven by, you know, my ego. And so sometimes the sense of pleasure, the power give, the illusion of power, it's the lure of power, of course, is strong. So, you know, there was a bit of both. And it's like sometimes you go down a path and understand that it's a dead end, okay, you know, go back and start again. And so I always kept the compass. I always know where I was going. Just sometime that curiosity of youth to say, yeah, okay, let me just you know, try here a little bit, you know, let me see. Thanks God, I always said that compass is okay and go back on the main path.
I think I heard, maybe it was in the interview with our mutual friend Gil, that you met Castaneda in Mexico. And maybe my inference is that you met Don Juan also. Is that accurate?
I don't know about Don Juan. I mean, one of the teachers of Carlos, which is the person that I met, and is the person that then introduced us, he was alive until not so many years ago. I don't know now. It was Don Mateo. He was very old. You know, I believe probably that maybe that's the person that the character of Don Juan is based on. We will never know. Yeah, so I don't know.
Okay, I've read through all of those of the Castaneda Don Juan books a couple of times,
I never read any one of them, so I have no idea.
Well, there's all kinds of miraculous things that happen in those stories, but as a result of, you know, just the practice, you know, like he'll do something and then he'll find his body, you know, miles away and be like, oh, now I have to like get back to where I started and I have no idea how I got here, you know, things like that. Or he learns to, you know, sort of teleport from one place to another, but he's practicing, just like awareness of the tonal versus the nahual, you know, the understanding what the physical world is, who, you know, the egoic creation versus like who the fuller self. And so the teleportation is just sort of like an aspect of that study. So, okay, maybe a little interesting context would be your journey is finished. Where are you now, sort of in life?
Comfortable on my chair. I hanged my Indiana Jones set really a while ago. Believe it or not, I mean, I pretty much retired from the whole teaching industry as well. I'm just a regular guy doing business and, you know, living a fairly ordinary life. I mean, you know, really, really quite simple. I mean, of course, I retain something precious from this long journey. You know, it's like everything is the same. I wake up, I drink my coffee, I live my life, I do my things. But at the same time, everything is different. So there is a before and after, but it's more sort of an inner quality. It's not something necessarily that shows in a strange way I dress, or a strange way I eat, or a strange way I live, or in strange things I believe, right? It's knowing, it's something that remains with me inside and is the base of a quality of living, call it maybe a mental state, or let's maybe call it a mental state that become commercial, become sort of natural. You know, you don't really need to do anything, it's already become you. You are already it. I don't really say it, right? And so certain states of absorption or meditation that profound intimate connection with yourself is there. You know that connection between, you know, the body mind continuum. It's there. You know, you don't really need to do anything for it. It's there. I do my maintenance to a certain extent, lay person kind of routine of practice because it's an habit. That's really the truth of it. And also because I wouldn't be able probably to be without it because it becomes so ingrained in who I am. But yeah, I mean, that is it. I mean, once in a while, when I have feelings of inspiration, I go and see some of my teachers. Sometime, it's been quite a while, if I have desire, I go for a retreat. But, you know, other than that, I live a fairly ordinary life.
Interesting. And do you have a sense for, I don't know what term you would consider it, but like what is the your service now to, do you think of it that way, like your role in terms of what you're here to do, or?
No, I don't think that I have any special role or I did my journey and I live my life. That's it. I mean, you know, I try to be, you know, good to the people around me, and that's it. You know, I'm not really. I don't believe in all these things. You know, yeah, I don't have that. I don't really know what to tell you on that.
Yeah, interesting. Was it a conscious decision to hang up the Indiana Jones hat or the teaching hat?
Yeah, it was. I mean, and to a great degree, it wasn't really my choice. I was already in the mountains, and I kind of already gave up this life. I was in very long retreats, to speak of years, mountains and jungles. And you really don't need anything anymore, not even sex. It's like you're just somewhere else. Okay? And you don't need people, don't need to talk to anyone. You know, you're just there. Once every blue moon, you go and see your teacher, or your teacher come and see you. That's it. You know, and I was happy. I didn't want to come back. I wanted to just keep going until the end of the path, you know, sort of that kind of call it self-realization or awakening in this very life. So that was sort of, you know, the motto, right, the drive. You know, I will not give up until it's been achieved. And it's a very radical transformation of your personality to a degree of your identity as well. And then my teacher told me, that's it, you need to go back. And I didn't want to go back. It was very difficult. It was very difficult. it's the bond between student and teacher that you do what your teacher says no matter what. So it's okay. I'll go back. And so there was a bit of a transition going back, which lasted several years. And then I tried to teach for a period, thinking, okay, maybe I need to come back and teach, but to try to figure out how to do it, you know, so and so on. And that kind of the transition finished, and I'm back. I stopped teaching and I started a business, you know, like making real money in the real world.
Did your teacher say why you had to come back?
Interesting, yes.
He had a reason, but it's private. Okay.
And you don't question your teacher, you know. Even if what they tell you, you don't agree with it, you don't feel it, you don't understand it, it's not a democracy. The relation between a teacher and a student is not a democracy. He is the king, you are the servant. He is the master, you are the slave. And it's either that or it's not a relationship between, you know. Mm-hmm. Guru can, then it can work. Nowadays in the West, I see a lot of people, you know, they want to be your peers. Okay? We're all dudes at the same level, we all share experiences. It's not how I was raised in this world, you know. It's like my teacher always told me, if you have two cups, one is empty and one is full. And the empty cup won't be filled. The full cup needs to be on top in order to fill the lower cup. So you need to willingly lower yourself. There is no way around. So that's why I was raised. And that's why it's also difficult for me to teach, because I learned in very traditional way. And it's very hard. It's very hard. And and I find that most people can't take it. Or they find it difficult to establish, you know, the kind of relationship to receive the teachings.
So if you were to be someone's teacher, you would assume the role of the way your teachers were with you, and you would want your student to be sort of.
I don't want students. That's what I say. I don't have this fantasy or this desire. It's a very big responsibility to be a teacher.
But I imagine people are coming to you asking to be your students.
Yeah, I send them away. I say no. Go away. Why me? There are so many people out there teaching. You know, I have to the truth that logically, I have to keep, especially my wife. You know, she really pushed me to keep her foot inside the door. And so once in a while, I actually really teaching now is difficult, but I give some time, like talks, like with you, or in some Telegram channel where I send you the thing. We have this Telegram channel for the English speaking people, or, you know, sometimes I give there some talks or a dialogue, question and answers or something. And yeah, sometime if I'm inspired, maybe I teach. Sometimes, and for me nowadays it's like it's a hobby. So I really I was in the teaching industry for quite a while.
Yes,
that means it's an industry. So you need to sell yourself. You need to sell something. You need to, you know, make money from that, because that's how you earn your living. And I did it for many years, and for many years was all right, but I understood that that's not my cup of tea. So let's say for me now teaching, I'll do it when and if I have desire to, at the condition that I set for it, when the time is right, for who I think is right. Okay. And that is it. You know, it might be that it changes in the future. I mean, there are no absolute in my life other than love. Everything else is relative. So maybe, I don't know, you know, when I finish my business journey, it may happen, and maybe I will be a public teacher and teach to the masses. I mean, who knows? I don't know.
What motivates or drives you these days?
Money and love and good sex, always. Simple things.
Okay. Do you have a sense of I just keep coming back to why you okay, because I'm reading Autobiography of a Yogi right now, and his guru said, you're going to go to America and you're going to spread yoga to the West. This was in the 1920s through essentially the 60s, and he was like, okay, yeah, whatever you say. Because it's that kind of relationship. And so he came, he started, you know, he brought yoga to the West, did many decades of speaking tours, and then I haven't finished the book yet, so I don't know what happened. But basically, you know, he listens to whatever his guru tells him to do. And then later he realizes, like, ah, I see why you made me go to America. I see my role here. And I'm kind of still stuck on, like, just curiosity about, you know, like what it was that brought you back to this. If there's anything else you can say about that.
Look, I mean, yes, I have for sure two of my sort of heart teachers that for sure have a desire for me to, not necessarily maybe only for me as a person, but probably to promote the teachings of Dharma, specifically of certain practices, you know, like they are represented in the documentary at the end, the Sky Gate, or some of these things. So, yes, there is maybe a kind of a ecumenic or missionary halo to some of these. And yes, of course, I know that one of my teachers had this desire to say that at least 1 million practice, 1 million people should practice altogether. These, you know, and it would be very good and so on. But he's also the same guy that said that I should become a monk and then more people would benefit, you know, if I would, you know, put their family pyjama and shave my head. And I'm like, forget it. I'm never going to do that, you know, because I don't believe in that. It is not me. So yes, I mean, you know, there are things, but I'm not perfect. I'm not a Paramahansa Yogananda. I'm not a Paramahansa. I'm just a guy that had a long journey, and I have my own realizations. And the journey was done without the purpose to one day teach to millions of people. It was a journey done for my own self, and find some answer to some strong burning questions, and I found my answers and I lived my life. Yes, I've been teaching for many years, different kind of things, from Taoist practices, Qigong, Buddhist, Tantric. I've been teaching so much through the years, you know, so there is no shortage of teachings given. But if you speak about a real sense of a mission or a purpose, when I was younger, maybe, yes, I was a little bit more, you know, oh, yes, that's my mission. I will come down. I gave myself that mission. When I came down from the retreats, when my teacher say, go back, I try to find the purpose. Yes, maybe I need to bring these things for many people, blah, 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 blah. But it was making on my own mind. I mean, you know.
Mm.
Can't really say that I heard it from or that my teacher really gave it to me as a thing, you know. No. He just said, yes, I believe it could be very good if this knowledge is open and many people practice it, you know, but it was not like, yes, you have to go back and teach and you know, la 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 la.
Am I correct when you were up in the mountains, you spent some time as a breatharian, not eating and just sort of existing on prana or?
Well, I mean, again, those were some of the many experiences that I had through the years. I mean, I had a few teachers in the tantric tradition, in the yoga tradition in India, and again, also in China that they had this gift and they can put people in this suspended state so that you don't need to eat for a very long period of time and sustain mostly on sunlight and whatever. You know, I did many long fastings during my ascesis years from 3 days, 5 days, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, 20 days. I did some period of 2 months nearly without eating anything. But, you know, was that a breatharian? I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, like I just didn't eat for a period of time. Did it mean that I could have stopped eating for the rest of my life? I don't know. I just had a very long fasting. I mean, why make such a big fuss out of it? You know, if you have enough body fat, okay, you can don't eat and pretty much don't drink for 40, 50 days. You don't need any great mystical things. But that doesn't make you breatharian. It just, you are having a very, very long fasting. And there is a very long living tradition of mystics around the world that do this regularly. I've done it. Doesn't make me breatharian. You just have a very, very long fasting and you go through many things and it's a very interesting process for sure. And it's true that especially if you do it, you know, as a deliberate choice, you'd be surprised that you don't really feel hunger. And You feel amazing.
Man,
I
did an 8-day fast.
But from there to say I'm a Bretarian, there is a big, very, very, very big thing in between, right? So people that really can live without food for years, okay, that's a Bretarian. Somebody that goes for a long fast of 30, 40, 50 days, that doesn't make him a Bretarian, okay?
Okay.
Let's be very clear here, okay?
Yeah, that's amazingly impressive, though, to go that long. I mean, I did 8 days, and it was not that enjoyable, honestly. I was continuing with my normal existence. You know, I was going to people's birthday parties and things like that, and it was really just smelling delicious food that made me most
upset. No, when I was doing these things, I was either alone or, you know, without social life, and so of course it was without delicious mess around. Mostly praying or meditating or breathing.
What is your, you said you have a little bit of a maintenance practice or just the practice that you default to because it's part of you. What does that look like?
Yeah. It's the highest and most important practice. It's the only practice. Love is the answer. When you understand that, there are no more questions. But again, it can take a lifetime. And you think that there are many questions and many amazing answers. There is only one answer, and it's love. And there are no questions there. The practice is love. And love is action. Love is living. Love is contemplation. Love is meditation. It's the breath within the breath. It's the spark of life. It's the light of our mind. It takes many names, many forms. It appears as your guru. It appears as your Ishvadevata, as your tutelary deity. It appears as yourself. It appears in many forms. But you need to know what it is. If you don't recognize it, you miss the chance because you think it's something else. And that's misguided practice. In the tradition, we speak of the missed chances. Because you don't recognize what's in front of you. You think it's something else. So that's really the answer. Then again, the way that it's practiced is in many ways, but mostly it's through living, through being, through breathing, through laughing, living, loving, and making love and being in the world and meditating on the nature of love, the presence of love. The light, the inherent light of your own mind, they call it in Sanskrit Prabhasvara, the ground of the mind, the luminous nature of the mind. Is that love from love, light from light, that unity. And you don't need anything. Once you have seen it and you know it's you, then you know, what do you need to do? It's you. It's like you're yourself, you know. Yeah, you don't need even to close your eyes and tell you the truth. I mean, yes, you can close your eyes, but you don't need to.
What is a way that you might approach helping someone that was not recognizing love or was stuck in a pattern where they just had an experience of life where it was just hard or frustrating or, you know, where they couldn't break free of just like seeing the negative everywhere. How would you approach that?
I probably would send them in some starving country in Africa, in Yemen, Iraq, in Syria, in India. And let them do some real missionary work. Really see what is suffering. Not the suffering of, I'm depressed with my chai latte in my hands. really see, really feel, really, really hit that suffering, hit you. Break that shell that separates you from others. And in that moment, you may have a chance to actually understand, recognize love. That's what my teachers did with me. That's what I would do with people. There is no, now I will tell you, if you are stuck in the pattern of your negative now, close your right eye, your left nostrils, and focus here and visualize there. That's nonsense. That's fantasy. Okay. Go. Leave everything that you have. Change the context of your life. Go in a context so far and so different from the one that you're used to that you have no chance of recognizing yourself. And in the moment that you start to forget yourself, your story, your pain, me, because this, and you actually finally, by forgetting yourself, you start to emerge from that cave that keep you in prison, then suddenly you actually start to see others and realize that there are no others. It's you out there suffering. And in that union of that suffering, there is that miracle. That's where love starts to happen. The Buddha said that the first truth after his enlightenment, he pondered for 7 weeks, if to teach at all. He was just thinking, should I teach this Dharma? And there are the stories that the gods came and say, you need to teach, and blah, blah, blah. And then he decided to teach. And what is interesting is that he said there are four truths. The first truth is the truth of suffering. And if you do not realize that suffering, that is first and foremost within you, if you don't let it smash you and hit you and destroy you, the other three truths can be realized. So Dharma, the path of awakening, the path of liberation, begins with suffering. If you try to shield yourself from suffering, that's what's happening in at large in Western society, I think in the US even more. People numb themselves because they can't suffer. They don't want to suffer. They run away from it because it's unbearable. And they medicate themselves. And meditation is a form of medication. It's just escaping. That's not Dharma. How can you ever even imagine that you would become free, let alone liberated or enlightened? The first step is suffering, and that suffering needs to be real and experienced. And has to be recognized inside you. And you have to break that wall that separates you from others until you can really see. And so the very first step in spiritual practice, I believe, the recognition of that suffering, which is then, is interesting because although those are the words of Buddha, but again, let's come back to our, Judeo-Christian heritage. We very well know in the Judeo-Christian tradition the role and value of suffering that then has been twisted, perverted, abused by the church institution, okay, for sure. But that value, that symbol, of that man on the cross with the crown of thorn, bleeding, suffering. It's such a powerful image for a reason. Because that thorn, the crown of thorn in the heart that bleed the heart, that heart bleeding, what is bleeding out is love. Rumi, Jalaluddin Mevlana Rumi, the founder of the Sufi order. He said, you shall break your heart again and again until love comes out. And that's not fun. It's not a nice, let's go and have a yoga shala session. No. It's not, okay, let's sit to the pillar now and meditate for 30 minutes of mindfulness. No. So that's what I would recommend to people that are stuck. To begin. Probably a few other things I would recommend too, but to begin with that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, just get in there. And I've had that experience of the point where you don't have an identity anymore. It's quite an interesting phenomenon that I got when I was in Bali, actually. And I think one of your in one of your documentaries, the guy with the leaf, the who's like shocking you with the leaf, that's in Bali, yes.
He passed away. He's dead already.
Oh no. Okay.
Many of these people passed already, unluckily. Yeah, this solution of the identity is I think it's overvalued. I mean, it's over. People make again a very big fuss out of it. It's not it. If you know how to manipulate your breath well, if you take certain plants like ayahuasca, if you do different things, you can have these moments where, you know, you're that's not it. Because then you come back and you're still stuck and you're still searching and you're still looking and you're still lost. That's not it. It's a nice experience, yes, but that's not it. And did you miss to recognize what had to be recognized? Otherwise, it's just another missed chance. Okay. It's another experience. Having coffee, having sex, having an ego death is the same. Just another experience. They come, they go. They appear, they disappear. They are, the Buddha say, anicca, anatta. They are impermanent, without self, without ultimate nature. Okay. That's not the object of refuge. That's not what will grant liberation.
I think this may be a good place to wrap up our interview. I can tell there's lots more interesting stories there, but is there anything I haven't asked you about that you think is important to mention today?
Ask me about love. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you said you love all the time. Tell me about love.
Well, I wish I loved it. I'm far from it, but you know, it's a daily practice, a daily effort. I always remind people that our work is to bring cosmos, to bring order into the world. I remind people that everything in our world is bound by the laws of thermodynamics. That means everything in our world is bound by entropy, which means everything decays. Okay? Which means, using the words of the Buddha, everything is impermanent. Everything. Your body, your emotional states, your relationships, your business, everything. And every day you wake up and you need to be that hero that go out and bring back order into the chaos, into the entropic system. Because everything every day needs that, everything that is gradually going to a dissolution, a disgregation, a decay, every day you need to go back and bring back order. In your mind, in your body, in your emotion, in your relation, in your house, in your work, every day you do that. And there is no ending to this until the day you die. It's not that it's something that you did it today. Oh, great. I'm done. No. And it takes power. It takes energy. It's not easy to wake up every day in a world that is by nature chaotic and entropic and say, today again, I will bring order within myself and around me. For that, you need resources. You need resources of energy. You need mental resources. You need, you know, strategy. You need the will to do it. You need a reason and a vision why to do it. And that's the thing where I believe where love comes into play. Because it is the higher order, the higher ordering force, okay, that we all carry within ourselves. You don't need to acquire from outside. It can't be bought, it can't be sold. You can't pay enough for it. There is no price for it. And yet, it's available to you at all times. At all times. This is what is so incredible. And is effervescent. That means that the more you use it, the more it grows. Any other form of energy, the more you use it, the more it's depleted. Love is unique. The more you use it, the more it multiplies. And it changes and it transforms you and those around. And is always, always available to you. You just need to touch it, trigger it, awake it inside you. And you don't need complicated things. Okay. It can be with your favorite song, with your favorite painting, looking at your woman or hugging a friend, helping someone that needs help. Feeling the pain of someone and forgetting for 1 second of your own pain. Simple things. And when you feel that love, it's a feeling that everybody knows. And in the moment, it just feels so good. It feels better than everything else. And everything else you forget. Trust me. All these miracles, levitation, I forget them. I already don't remember them. But every time I have loved, I remember it. Every single time my heart opened, I remember. Love touches you and transforms you forever. Because it's your true nature, it's your essence. So every time that you love, you remember yourself. And you don't need, you can't remember yourself by levitating or shooting lasers from your hands. But you can only remember yourself by being yourself, by exercising who you are. Love a little every day. And you will find incredible resources to put order in the world, into this entropic system that we live in, to put order in your mind, in your emotion, in your heart, okay? In your house, in your relationship, in your work. That's the main thing. Then there are a lot of other things that you can use. Breathing, movement. I always say that the ingredients of the cakes are always the same. A cake is made of flour, eggs, butter, sugar, those four things are the basic, right? And then depending how you bake it, how you mix it, okay, you can have so many different things. Spiritual practices, remember, don't need to make such a big fuss out of it. They are always made of the same basic ingredients. You have a body, movement, you breathe, you imagine, you feel, and you say, you speak. That's it. See, 5 things. All spiritual practices of the world over. Okay, it's just a combination of these 5 basic things. But how you bake them, how you cook them, how you mix them, create many different things. But none of these things will come together into a delicious cake if you don't bake it in the oven of your heart, if the fire of love is not on. So, I leave you with this reflection. And yes, of course, there are online courses. Several online courses I put of these very powerful practices, breathing, they come from the tradition of the heart mirror, the Buddhist tantric line, and they come from all these great enlightened gurus. Incredible practices. Please, of course, by all means, learn them. You know, they are available online for just a few dollars. And again, it's not like a business here. Come and learn, I promise. You want to join this English-speaking group? I'm inspired to talk, I'll talk. Not necessarily what you want to hear, but maybe what you need to hear. But the most important is love.
Mm. I feel it. Good. It's landing for me. And also
it's
your words.
It's always there. It's the only thing that is always available to you. You can always reach it. It can't be bought, it can't be sold. And it's boundless, infinite, effervescent, never exhausted.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you for your words. And do you want to direct people to find you anywhere, or would you like to send people?
No, because I don't. I send you the links. I mean, you.
Okay. Yeah, we'll include those.
From a call on the Telegram channels, I send. You can send if people are interested. Please. Then when the web page
yes.
will be on, we will make it. I will send.
Okay.
English David Verdesi channel. My wife showed me the Telegram. English David Verdesi channel. Anyway, you have it. I send you.
Yeah,
can
yeah.
Send it to your
guys. I can. I'll post all of them for people.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye bye.